Once upon a time, there were four little rabbits.
How old are you, Johnny? She asked.
16.
We few, we happy few, we band of brothers.
It was the best of times. It was the worst of times.
A wise old king once said, "Of the making of books, there is no end." How true today. Of the overabundance of writing published each year, what's worth reading? The answer is simple. Read only the best. Come join the discussion on Just the Best Literature.
Hello again, everyone. Thanks for listening in today. Well, I don't have any comments today, and you know what? That's probably a really good thing. Today, I want to just jump right back into our discussion of Chapter 2 on Aqaba, and I am again very excited to have the 60+1 panel back with me today. So welcome back, Deborah.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Yes, and welcome back, James.
Thank you.
It's always good to have some company on the set here or on the studio. Well, Josh Sloan's always here, but he's just no fun. I mean, he's just making sure we get no static, but I just gave him static, didn't I? Yeah. So let's just jump right back in. And we wanted to talk about geography last time. And so I know my wife is just really anxious to talk about the horrible geography that Lawrence had to deal with to take Aqaba. So I'll let you go at it, dear.
Well, I mean, he does describe some of the horrible things he had to go through. And on page 78, Korda says that he talks about Lawrence, and he says he had the gifts of a great nature writer, and presents, he's talking about what he wrote in Seven Pillars of Wisdom. He said, and presents with a kind of detached objectivity the hardships of desert travel, a fierce sandstorm which sends pebbles and whole small trees flying at his party like projectiles, followed by heavy rain and a sudden drop in the temperature that leaves him and his party shivering. The wind is so strong that Lawrence's robes get in his way as he climbs a rocky crag, so he strips and makes his way naked up the sharp, slippery rocks, and then one of his servants falls headfirst to his death. And then it says later, he says later, the cold was intense, he wrote later, and our teeth chattered, and we trembled and hissed involuntarily while our hands drew in like claws. Only the day before, the heat had been so oppressive that Lawrence had been unable to walk barefoot, to the amusement of the tribesmen, whose thick soles were proof even against slow fire. It is worth noting that the desert provides every kind of torment: heat, cold, rain, flash floods, windstorms, biting insects, and sandstorms, sometimes all on the same day.
Sounds like Oklahoma.
Right, yes.
In the middle of summer.
Yes, right, yes.
Oklahoma in the middle of summer. Yeah, to me, of course, when you read that, and I have been starting to read a little bit of Seven Pillars of Wisdom. He is a great writer, by the way, and he is really great with the natural environment. But the one thing about Lawrence, and let's remember, anybody that's seen the movie Lawrence of Arabia, you've got to get Peter O'Toole out of your mind. And you have to remember, Lawrence of Arabia is 5'5". You know, he's really not very tall. I mean, he's actually smaller than I am. I'm 5'9" and shrinking. So he's smaller than I am. He's very blonde, very blue-eyed, probably good fair skin. And yet he was able to take Aqaba from the desert. And even the Arabs said, "You're crazy. No one has ever crossed that area." And he said, "Well, how many days do you think it'll be?" And they said, "It'll be this many days." And he said, "Well, we better get started, you know." So, but just to hear what Deborah read there, it really is, it is amazing. And what Korda brings out earlier in the book, or just a few pages earlier, if we go back to page 73, is it made him intensely sick. You know, I mean, he got dysentery. He would hallucinate. Here's what he says on page 73. And again, I hope everybody is really paying attention to this, even as James said the last program, it's a little hard to get into the book because there's so much you have to learn. But once you learn that, I mean, the book just takes on this incredible dimension. And he says, perhaps his own illness and the greater importance in the grand scheme of things of reaching Amir Abdullah as soon as possible with a message about Medina, which ironically turned out to be false, helped Lawrence to put the incident out of his mind. And, you know, he's talking about, I think, where he had to execute this guy for starting this blood feud. And Lawrence had to execute, I think his name was Hamed. He had to execute him because if one of the other Arabs had executed him, then it just started more blood feud. So if you can think about, I mean, what a kind of a horrible thing Lawrence had to go through. So he had to actually... even though he was a great shot, he shot the guy and it didn't kill him. Shot him again, didn't kill him. Then he had to shoot him a third time, and it finally killed him. So that was just kind of, kind of a horrible thing to have to go through. But the point is it was really the whole desert was so intense, and it made him sick, and he really started to, really have physical problems. Got the dysentery, and really, really almost like could have died. It talks about that on page 73. Then on 74, I mean, just to go through this, it's the bottom of the page. It says, Lawrence spent about 10 days in his tent suffering a bodily weakness that made my animal, he says this in Seven Pillars of Wisdom, suffering a bodily weakness that made my animal self crawl away and hide till the shame was past. He said this surely refers to dysentery, a common enough illness among Europeans living with the Bedouin and unaccustomed to tainted water and unhygienic surroundings. Lawrence's symptoms may have also been intensified by some degree of what we would now call post-traumatic stress disorder brought about by the execution of Hamed. In any event, for 10 days he rested and tried to recuperate in his stifling tent, drowsing, plagued by flies, and thinking about military strategy. Eventually he came to the conclusion that any attempt to take Medina would be a mistake. As Lawrence himself put it, he woke out of a hot sleep, running with sweat and prickling with flies, and wondered what on earth was the good of Medina to us. And then in another book, in Colonel Lawrence, Liddell Hart bases his claim for Lawrence as a military genius on the sick bed musings in Abdullah's camp. Indeed, the conclusions that Lawrence reached about war as he set them out in Seven Pillars of Wisdom 5 years later, defined very well the kind of warfare that big Western armies found it so hard to win against through much of the 20th century. And the first decade of the 21st. First of all, Lawrence reached the conclusion that in irregular warfare, it made no sense to hold or seize a specific point. The goal was to strike the enemy where he least expected to be attacked, then vanish back into the desert and to avoid so far as possible big battles in which the enemy could put to use his superior firepower and military discipline. So here it was this intense desert that really, if you look at it the way I understand it, it gave him the time to think things through and to really kind of take advantage of the desert.
Yeah, I don't think if I was suffering dysentery for 10 days, I'd be musing on military strategy.
Right.
I'd suffer in ignorance.
Yeah. Right. But can you imagine being... getting bit by flies and, trying to stay while he was being baked.
Yes, and another place, I forget where it was, maybe it was right there, was one of the Arabs offered him his tent, and it would have been better for him to sleep outside the tent, because in the tent there was lice and flies and all that. He was, yes.
Yes. So, insult to injury.
Yeah. So on top of the desert then, there was the Arabic people had no sense of sanitary conditions. So do you want to say something about that, James?
There's a scene in the book that immediately came to my mind where it's not just Lawrence. A couple of the other British officers, I think Vickery was among them, came and joined, and they were all sitting there, and they're sitting down trying to have a meal. And Lawrence tucks in with the rest of the Arabs, but the two of the other British officers were struggling with their appetite because they're basically in this giant flat area, and there's just camel and human excrement
everywhere,
openly out in the field around them, and they're trying to eat basically rice and sheep fat. Lawrence has no problem with any of this. He's quite accustomed to this life at this point, but the other officers that were recently arrived really had a hard time making themselves at home in that kind of environment.
Yeah. So it is kind of amazing when you think about it. How did the Arabs survive? You know, they love their tents, they love their camels. I mean, many of them are very wealthy people today. But they still spend 3 or 4 months a year in their tents, out in the middle of nowhere, you know, baking, you know, so and no sanitation, mm-hmm. you know, I do think it's kind of fascinating. I think the other thing about the geography that we have to understand was the importance of the wells, and even biblically, if you look back to the whole history of Abraham and Isaac. There was always, if any of the other tribes were mad at you, they went and they tried to shut down your wells. And if there's one scene in the book of Genesis after Abraham dies, and Isaac goes back and he opens up all the wells that Abraham's enemies had, you know, shut down all of his wells. So that was really, really important. And of course, we know that the Turks were doing that. They were going down and they were shutting down the wells. And that just made it even more difficult when we just focus on, you know, what Lawrence had to cross to get to the back door of Aqaba, and I guess there was a major lava field that when the sun beat down on it, it was like a mirror, and I guess he actually burned his feet where he couldn't actually, you know, walk for a while because it was so hot. So I mean that's pretty intense desert heat, and I think it's also interesting. There is that it's also shown in the movie Lawrence of Arabia, where the one man, one of his, I guess one of the Arabic fell off of his camel, and he was left. The camel kept coming with them, and they didn't notice. They were gone for hours. They didn't notice that the guy had fallen off of his camel, and they finally looked back. And then Lawrence, he had such a love of life that he refused to let that guy just, I mean, he'd have been dead. He would have just, well, I guess been incinerated by the heat. He would have died of thirst. He decides to go back and get him. You know, so it just shows what a tough nut I think Lawrence was to hear, like I said, a blonde white guy taken on the desert, and he survived.
Yeah, he did. And it gets more into it further along in the book too, but I've just been impressed so much with this man's threshold for suffering. You know, you could put him through anything, and he exposed himself to a lot of that before even the war. And again, that comes in later in the book, but with his walking journeys and things throughout the Middle East, he went through a lot of those things willingly for his own experience and for his own education, and he built up that tolerance before even the war came along, and he really did earn the respect of the Arabs around him just through his sheer physical toughness and his compassion as well in that instance you just mentioned, where he turned back to find that guy that had fallen off his camel.
His name was Ghazem, and that's pages 86 and 87, by the way, for those of you out there listening.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And they poked fun at him in a way for going back and doing that, but he did earn their respect, you know, and they saw how tough he was, but also how much, you know, he was not willing to leave any man behind. I think that for any foot soldier, that's probably a nice thing to see in a man that you're
right.
You're following.
Right. I mean, it's I just think that shows so much of his loyalty to the Arabic people. And, of course, you know, what? Here's what Korda says about that whole situation, page 87, middle paragraph. He says, indeed, by rescuing Ghazem, he had lived up to the ideals of courage the Bedouin admired most, but by no means always followed themselves, particularly when those ideals involved the rescue of a stranger, of a man of another tribe. So some of the people, like he said, the Bedouin, they really admired him for doing that. And that was supposedly one of their character traits, but they didn't even do it. You know, no one else wanted to go back to get that guy.
And he does say that it added to his legend.
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It really added to that. And so anyway, I think also, let's talk about a little bit about the Arabs again here. This is now that we're right here on page 87. Let me just read this one paragraph here. It says, even when they finally reached the water at the wells of Arfaja, the desert still proved to be dangerous. That night, while they were drinking coffee around the fire, unseen assailants shot at them until Ada's cousin kicked sand over the fire, putting it out, at which point they drove their attackers away with a fusillade of rifle shots, though not before one of their own was killed. They rode on the next morning, and on the 20th day since leaving Wej, they reached the tents of Hawatat, Ada's own tribe, where they feasted with one of those lavish meals that Lawrence loves so much, hot grease and pieces of a mutton on a bed of rice, decorated with single heads of the slaughtered sheep.
Tasty.
Yes, lovely. Yes.
So anyway, I guess that was high desert living. We don't want to mock the Arabs. Lawrence will come back and get us if we do that. All right, let's move on to another subject. And I think everybody, we're going to hear a lot more about the desert. But if you have not seen the movie Lawrence of Arabia with Peter O'Toole, David Lean produced that movie. And I think there are great views in that film about the desert and how hard it was. And if you can't get the image from reading Korda's book, certainly you could get the image from watching that film. I think it doesn't have everything that I'd like to see it have, but Peter O'Toole is like 6'5", and so that kind of destroys it for me. But anyway, I think it's worth just seeing how intense the desert was, and like I said, even us in Oklahoma. Sometimes if it gets above 100, it can be pretty unbearable here as well. All right, so let's continue with this. I think it'd be good if we talk a little bit about the problems, let's say, that Lawrence had covered with the British military. And then I think we could also, to not be unfair to the British, we'll kind of skip the French a little bit because he doesn't really get into the French that much. And all we know is the French, just all they cared about was getting their part of the Pike-Sico agreement, or the Sykes-Picot agreement. I mixed that back up. I was dyslexic there, not even reading anything. But let's look at the problem with the Arabs as well. I think if I could just let's go to page 64, and let's talk about Newcomb and Vickery. So I brought this up earlier in a program, but the thing, and James, I'll ask you to chime in here, but I think Newcomb, I guess his name is, and Vickery, they kind of represent the extremes of the British military. And here's what Korda says about Newcomb. He says, Newcomb, though he is a professional soldier to the core, knew Lawrence well and liked him. So here you have these professional soldiers. Now, Vickery almost instantly did not. He and Lawrence got off on the wrong foot from the very beginning. He was offended by Lawrence's unmilitary ways and, more important, by Lawrence's easy assumption that Faisal and Faisal's army would reach Damascus, when so far as Vickery could see, they were hard-pressed to reach Wej on time and in good order. So I think those few sentences kind of describe to me the British and the Middle East. So what do you think about that, James?
I think that you're hitting the nail on the head here. This was dealing with the Arabs. The English found that incredibly difficult, the English military in particular, because the things that the average British officer really held in high esteem, discipline, punctuality, adherence to, strict matters of etiquette and all the various rules and sort of unwritten mores that came along with being part of the British Army that made it sort of the towering and monolithic institution that it has been throughout history, the Arabs had none of that. And for Lawrence, one of their own, to so willingly embrace the way that the Arabs did things and sort of take the Arabs' side in many cases, that really rubbed some of the dyed-in-the-wool British officers the wrong way, like Vickery, who really just couldn't get past the surface differences, I think. I think there were some like Newcomb and later Allenby that were able to kind of see past Lawrence's carefully crafted facade and see that, ultimately they wanted the same things. But I think it's very difficult for the British soldiers to deal with the Arabs and get along, which, looking back in hindsight, is now why we know why Lawrence was so important to any sort of success in this region, because you needed a man between. You needed a middleman. Someone that was willing to kind of approach it from both sides. Right. And nobody up to this point really had been able to do that successfully.
Right. Well, one thing I think is kind of fascinating to me is, first of all, I have to admit that it's really hard for me to pick on the British because, my wife knows that I'm like my background is 68% British, so in some ways I like, when I get dressed, I like my shoes polished. I like my tie straight, It would be probably a little hard for me to be around the Arabs at the same time. I like my wine and my glass, and even your grandfather and I were very close on that. We'd like our tea.
Knife and fork.
Yeah, and our knife and fork and, all that. So the thing is, you've got to be able to be flexible. And but I think even Lawrence realized he was a little too flexible and that it was really hard for him to return to Britain after what he experienced, in the Middle East. And, I think there's still questions about, his death on the motorcycle. It was untimely. He was a very good motorcyclist. They don't understand. There's a lot of mysteries around that. And so he was personally, he went back, he didn't know who he was. Was he British? Was he Arabic? That kind of thing. So I do think that it's important to say that the British just were too British to win this war. I think here's another thing that's really funny, and I just alluded to this a while ago. He said, matters were not helped. This is continuing that paragraph. When Vickery stubbornly insisted on wearing his Arab headcloth over his pith helmet, prompting one of the Arabs to exclaim, "Mashallah, the head of an ox." This set all the Arabs laughing, and Lawrence joined in. Vickery was both offended and humiliated and did not forgive Lawrence. Good as Vickery's Arabic was, he was of the Puka and Sahib type, believing strongly that Englishmen should stick together and maintain their distance and their dignity when dealing with natives. This was just the kind of attitude Lawrence was determined to eliminate in dealing with the Arabs. And so it just shows that, Lawrence really had a little better understanding. And then Newcomb, like you were saying, Newcomb and Allenby really did, kind of like him. And so the British had their own problems, but let's talk a little bit about the Arabs and their problems. They're fighting a war against the Ottoman Empire, so let's think about where their great weaknesses were.
Yeah, one common recurring theme throughout this chapter and a couple of the following ones is they don't really care about time.
Right.
Timelines, schedules mean nothing to them. And again, that's one of the core difficulties that they had in dealing with the British officers was just something that such a regular part of the British military, being on time, being on schedule, being punctual, didn't even factor in for them. There's one moment where some reinforcements, I think, were supposed to arrive for Lawrence in a particular battle, and he'd been promised 800 men and 300 showed up. And it was just a matter of accounting. He was promised 800. I don't even think that the man had 800 soldiers to give him. He just sent what he had, which is 300. So things like that made it quite difficult to keep a force disciplined. And like you alluded to earlier, some blood feuds and just allying all of these tribes, really. There is no such thing as one Arab nation. There were all these tribes and all these different peoples that really struggled to come together in
all
a unified
fighting each
group.
Other.
Yeah.
Yeah. One of the things that I thought was funny, that really kind of surprised me, that they had to stop for their mint tea and coffee. And it sounds to me like they would be great Starbucks flunkies or, groupies, because they had to have their pots and their cups and they had to have their coffee made just right. So I was kind of shocked by that and really kind of amused by all of that. So, yeah, definitely Lawrence understood that you can never make a regimental army out of the Arabs.
And he didn't try to.
And he didn't try to.
Yes.
And that really gave him a lot of success. Well, guess what, folks? We are out of time again. So that is all we have time for today's program. So next time, what will probably happen is I'll probably give you some final comments on Chapter 2, and then hopefully we can maybe start moving into Chapter 3. Now, Chapter 3 is where we get into the family background of Lawrence, and I think we'll find out in that chapter what drove him to become such a hero that he did. So remember now, for this current series of programs, we are using Michael Korda's book, Hero, The Life and Legend of Lawrence of Arabia. You can buy this book at Amazon.com. You can find a used copy of the book at abebooks.com. And, of course, you can also check your local library. So please write me any comments you may have to jbl@peaceug.org. You can follow JBL on Twitter at jbliterature1. And you can also follow JBL on Facebook. Simply search for Just the Best Literature. And so, until next time, keep reading.
You've been listening to Just the Best Literature on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, streaming online at kpcg.fm and thetrumpet.com.